What stood out for you from this judgment? My name is Patrick Kadhara, and I am the chief curator at the LFA. All right, today we're joined by a really strong and really knowledgeable panel of constitutional lawyers, people who've worked on the Constitution and helped reshape it for quite a long time. First off, we'll start with Tsango Chesoni, who's a lawyer, a renowned human rights advocate. She's a former deputy chairperson of the Committee of Experts that finalized the current constitution, the 2010 constitution. Zain Abubakar is a former executive director of the human rights organization Muhuri. He's a former commissioner with the CKRC, the Constitution of Kenya Review Commission, and also a former member of the East African Legislative Assembly. Waiku Wanyoike is a litigation director at the Open Society Justice Initiative. Before joining that, he co-founded and served as the executive director of Katiba Institute in Kenya. Wanyoike was admitted to practice law in Ontario, Canada. Marilyn Muthoni Kamuru is a feminist, entrepreneur, lawyer, writer, and policy advisor. She's an ardent advocate for women and gender equality and equity. All right, thanks all for joining us. First of all, what really for all of you, and this is, you can take it in turns, what stood out for you from this judgment? It's been described by people as landmark, it's been described as historic, you know. So what stood out? Maybe we start with you, Marilyn. What did you take out of it?
Thank you. I wasn't expecting you to start with me.
That's just how we roll here.
I know, right? Just throw me under the bus there. I think one of the things for me that was particularly ground-shaking was the language in this judgment, the very accessible language. The concepts are complicated, but there was a way in which this judgment was written for Kenyans, for us. And especially when I listened, actually, when they were delivering the judgment, and the accessibility of the language really struck me. At some point, my son was there, he's 11, and you know, he would follow and then he'd ask me a question, but he'd follow parts of what they were saying. And so it really struck me that this was not a judgment that was meant for lawyers and constitutional scholars. And so even in the way the judgment was written, it was sending us a very important message. The other thing that struck me was the clarity of the reasoning. There were a lot of issues, a lot of petitions. It really could have been a mess. And I remember having a conversation, I think, with Martha Karua when this case was filed, and I was like, oh my God, I just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, this case could just go helter-skelter. And so when I was reading it, I was really impressed by the clarity, the organization. It was very easy to follow, even where you might disagree. It's very easy to follow the reasoning and the rationale. And why I say that's historic is because sometimes the historic nature tends to just be the decision, but the process is something that we're starting as Kenyans to really start saying, listen, process matters. The way we get to a place matters. And I really saw that in this. And then finally, I will say one of the things that really struck me is not just the focus on the history, but also the focus on inclusion and participatory processes. The detail that they went to, you know, noticing the number of women who were required to be present, persons with disabilities, the extent to which the processes were quite prescribed, actually. I think that's the word. And not glossing over that really helped reaffirm some of the work that we've been doing post-promulgation. So I think I'll stop there.
I think that was great. Zain, if I may come to you, you worked on the CKRC, you worked on the case CKRC and on this constitution, the one we have. Do you think the judges captured what you guys were aiming at?
Thank you very much, Brother Kadhara. Yes, they did. Let me start off from where Marilyn stopped. So in order to share with Kenyans, the choice of the language that is used in writing the 2010 Constitution was also deliberate. Mm-hmm. It was also based on the demands of the people, but it also reflected the participatory nature of the Constitution itself. So the judges were working within the philosophy already established by the Constitution. Secondly, I think the judges got it right. For the first time in Kenya, we have a place where process and content are merged. Mm-hmm. So in order for you to understand the outcome of the Constitution review process, you need to understand the process and the historical context. And the debate that informed part of the review process. Right. Largely, there were two schools of thought. There were those who believed that constitution making is a process of only experts and should not involve Kenyans. Right. And
the careful, Wanjiku does not know what to do with a constitution.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right. But underlining that proposition is an acute disrespect of the people, mm-hmm. so that the people don't matter. But in the end, in the fullness of the review process, the people themselves replied to this question by saying, in the architecture and philosophy and design of our constitution, the fundamental principle is the sovereignty of the people. Right. So again, Article 1 of our constitution. So people affirmed themselves and said, this is about us. This is going to be about us. But also this is informed by a historical context, Brother Gadara.
Right.
The Lancaster talks, the three rounds of the Lancaster conferences, was not very participatory.
Right.
Asango may want to speak to this better than I, because we only had one woman who was accredited as an observer. So right. All the official delegates did not have any women in this. And we met the lady in the constitution making process. So it is important for us to say that the judges got it right, in my opinion, by saying you cannot talk about just outcome. You must also talk about process.
Or the process itself.
And what informed that outcome.
Right.
I'll give you two examples. The first one, go ahead, Gadara.
No, I was actually going to jump out to Atsango, but yes, just sure. Give the two examples that you wanted to, and then I can move on.
The first one is how carefully the Constitution of Kenya Review Act was negotiated.
Right.
And how carefully it was constructed, including putting a provision that required the final outcome must faithfully reflect the views of Kenyans.
Right.
Okay. But the second one is, again, something that came from the court, which is when it was tested that the Bomas Conference, the National Constitutional Conference, does it reach a sufficient critical mass to be called a constituent assembly? And the court said no. So the court said, you must finally, because this is not an elected delegates conference, although it is very participatory, right. But you must go back to the people through a referendum to either accept or reject the constitution. Right. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thanks for that. Atsango, you are also very involved in the making of the constitution. And I'm wondering, I mean, there's a lot, even the both Marilyn and Zain have mentioned this about sort of involving the people and how this is supposed to be a people's constitution. You know, there was quite a lot of contestation at the beginning in the early 2000s, etc., about whether it should be a constitution made by parliament or made by the people. And we ended up with one that is said to be reflective of us. To you, this judgment, and then given that history of development, what does the judgment mean in allowing people to own this culture, or to feel ownership of it. Is that what was basically reinforced?
Yes, for me, it's an affirmation of the principle of participation and of inclusion, the principles of participation, of inclusion, of the fact that whether it be policy or even legislation, let alone the constitution, the people must be consulted. And the constitutional reform process in this country actually, you know, affirms that principle. And so this judgment provides jurisprudence that affirms that principle. And it's a vindication of those of us's work to ensure participatory democracy, and the fact that we actually have a participatory democracy.
Right. Participation, what do you mean by that? Is it, I mean, because some people would argue it was going to go to a referendum, and that is participation.
Well, that's the beauty of the judgment. Right. It completely negates that myth. Mm-hmm. You know, participation is not at the last minute coming to people and saying, okay, do you agree with this? And yet, right from the beginning, they want part of it. And yet you have also appropriated their name.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, the judgment essentially says that you cannot claim that you're speaking for the people, and yet there is no evidence of them being the ones that were speaking.
Right.
And it's in things that are so basic as the fact that this country has two languages that are recognized by law, English and Kiswahili.
Right.
And we don't have a single draft of this supposed people's initiative in Swahili. This right. country also recognizes sign language, Kenyan sign language specifically, as a language. We have no evidence of attempts to ensure that people who are excluded by virtue of disability, be it people who face disability from the perspective of sight, mm-hmm. and therefore a braille publication of it, or discussions whereby the people were negotiating this constitution, these proposed amendments, and mm-hmm. availability of signed discussions, for example. So, yeah, and then even if you look at the principle of inclusion in terms of those who actually drafted BBI, mm-hmm. there's a dishonesty about that. If you look at the BBA draft itself, it talks about, quote unquote, the promoters. It doesn't tell you who these promoters are. One of the principles under Article 10 is transparency. Mm-hmm. So, and this is not one of the things that was talked, you know, that is talked about in discussing the judgment, but the very, you know, but that's the level of the opacity.
Right.
Yeah, that, you know, we don't even know who these supposed promoters are. Uh-huh. And so for me, the principle of inclusion, when you look, assuming that the promoters are the BBI task force, when you look at the makeup of that task force, and how it was put in place, and the fact that we were not even told that this task force was being put in place to amend the constitution. Mm-hmm. You know, as Abu has pointed out, as Zane has just pointed out, it was not enough that Bomas had a participatory process. When the court declared in those earlier decisions that you needed either a referendum or a constituent assembly, what it meant was that this country had moved to a level whereby we had said that if people are not elected specifically for the purpose of voting on a constitution, then right. we cannot say that this is, you know, this is the people.
That's what the mandate that we
need. Yeah, and I'm not going into the whole thing around like whether or not a popular initiative can be something that is, you know, I'm assuming we'll have those discussions a little later.
Right. Wanyeke, for you, what stood out? You wrote for The Elephant a piece about how it doesn't stop us from amending the constitution, but it does put certain strictures. What is it that stood out for you, and what do you think we should take from as an ordinary citizen listening to a bunch of lawyers speaking? You know, what is it that I should really so kind of focus on?
Thank you, Gathara. for me, a number of things that stood out. The first one is the centrality that the judges placed on history and used to anchor the decision. And this is extremely important because we know our governance, and especially since 2010 and even before, there has been a competition in terms of what the true history is. And there are people who are really keen on revising history. And this is why history was so important that it be reflected in a judgment like this that is so momentous. In fact, the most momentous judgment since the 2010 constitution came into being, and in fact, in Kenya judicial history. And I have to say, Zainab
Abubakar, you think it's more momentous than the annulment of the elections? A lot of people think that was a really huge.
Big. There's no comparison. There's no comparison because, first of all, this is about the life of the constitution and the integrity of the constitution. And when we talk about electoral justice, we're only talking about one aspect of the constitution.
Right.
But more importantly, an aspect that to some extent is actually very private. It's individuals fighting on who should be in power. And this is about the existence and the existence of a nation and the contract that people have with themselves about how they want to govern themselves and to be governed. So history for me and how just the judges went about rendering that history is unbelievable. The second is the where Muthoni started, just how judges managed to make such a technical subject so accessible. Some of us who pretend to be lawyers or to write like lawyers know sometimes how difficult it is to translate even basically very basic legal concept. Some of these issues are actually very, very technical, but yet the judges express themselves in such a way and the people were able actually to engage and feel as part of this litigation and to engage with the judgment. Two last points. One, the intellectual boldness of these judges. At two levels, this wasn't just an ordinary case. Remember, it's the one time the two feuding political side or the two political sides that pretend to feud came together and they have been rallying on one cause. Usually the judiciary, when it's making a decision, whether it's 2017 one, there's always a political side that is supportive of whatever outcome this would be. This was a case where the judiciary was largely alone. People also had given up. People thought that it was a shoe, referendum was a shoe-in. So largely the judges were just by themselves. And that level of boldness first, but also the depth of the intellect that they put in the judgment, for me, it's outstanding. And finally, obviously, related to the intellectual boldness is the thoroughness. And colleagues have spoken to that.
Yeah. One of the things, Tsangwe, if I may, one of the things that for me was interesting is comparing the how they defend the constitution now and how the judiciary in general, if you look at all the amendments that were passed to the independence constitution, the judiciary was missing as an actor that would stand up for the constitution. In fact, I think it was in 89 when they declared that they can't even enforce the Bill of Rights, what changed? What is it about the 2010 constitution that is different from the independence one, given that it seems they have many similar features, if you will, and it seems very much like 2010 was about reverting back to essentially to 1963?
Well, 2010 was not really totally about reverting back to 1963. I think there's a lot of lessons that had been learned. Mm-hmm. You know, and Abu will tell you because he's wonderful about this. You know, and CKRC did a lot of work on this. Between 1963 and 1969, most of the amendments that were problematic with respect to the old constitution were enacted. And so a lot of the work that went into the current constitution was around ensuring that you wouldn't have people that would be able to very quickly reverse and remove the provisions that we were that were being put in there. And this work actually precedes even CKRC. Mm. When, you know, as those of us who are members of the constitutional, those of us who participated in the constitutional reform movement, and Abubakar Zain and I both participated in that movement, people that were part of that process will tell you that when we would meet, the constitution was contraband. If you went to government printers in those days and asked to buy a copy of the constitution, they would ask you why.
Right.
We used to actually have to share, when we'd have those meetings at the Lemuru Conference Center, we would be sharing copies of the constitution and we would photocopy the old constitution. So now one of the issues with the old constitution was that even before the amendments, it already vested a lot of power in the executive. The president had the power to create or abolish any office not created by the constitution and not guaranteed by the constitution. Now, let me surprise you. Do you know that one of the offices that was not guaranteed by the constitution was the office of chief justice? Do you know that under the old constitution, you could appoint a chief justice that was not a lawyer? Do you know that this country had a chief justice that was not a lawyer? And so the judiciary, the judges did not have, were not guaranteed security of tenure. Mm-hmm. This is one of the ways that judiciary's independence was eroded. And although in 1963, they were guaranteed security of tenure, this is one of the things that eventually was taken away from them. It's the same type of issue in relation to the police, which we see BBI is trying to take away security of tenure for the police. And this is one of the ways in which they were again weakened under the old constitution. Now, yeah, one of the
judiciary differences was almost a department, I think, under the Attorney General or something.
Yes. And, you know, we've seen attempts to reintroduce those kind of practices. Now, here's the thing. Pre-2010, under the old constitution, it wasn't even illegal to do those kind of things. Now, at least it's unconstitutional. And so these are some of the gains with the constitution that BBI actually itself, both through the way in which they were attempting to introduce it, but also through some of the legislation that there've been attempts to introduce. You know, there was a recent case where the attempt to again place the judiciary and the constitutional commissions under governmental departments was again struck out. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so the constitution protects judges today in a way in which it didn't, basically.
Yeah.
It also attempts to give them financial independence.
Right, but I mean, it's arguable whether they have actually utilized that in a consistent fashion. I mean, we've seen cases where we'd assumed that certain protections would be upheld and they weren't. You remember, in fact, even after the annulment of the elections, they somehow couldn't find a quorum I think it was a month later to decide whether the subsequent election was legal. So is it that it's not they're not taking full advantage of what they have, or do we still have remnants of the old system that we need to get rid of?
It's more of one of the things that I've learned in the last 10 years is that it's not enough to actually change the legislative framework, who you give the opportunity and the constitutional framework, who you give the opportunity to ensure respect for these principles matters. So today what we have is a situation where in law, we have those guarantees, but sometimes we have people who hold office that either do not believe in those principles or are not willing to do what is necessary. And that's why Waikwa was talking about the boldness. One of the things about these judges is their courage, because I'm sure the judges knew that they would face the kind of attempts of innuendo, the opprobrium that they have faced. So we have to, for me, it's important that we acknowledge their courage.
Right. Yeah, but isn't Zain, if I ask you this, that they require courage, isn't that a bit of a problem? Because they should be protected. That would be the assumption that we've got a new dispensation that essentially gives them these protections and that they should be able to exercise their office without, we always say fear or favor. You know, what I wonder, I mean, I look at some of the ways our judges have carried themselves. I mean, we still have, for example, half, I think, of our prison population are people who have essentially been given bail at levels they can't afford. You know, and this is clear, although there is a bail and bond policy that was passed under Justice Mutunga. So it seems to me like at times they seem to act in a very illiberal way and to comply, if you will. So there's not this constant challenge to the exercise of executive authority that I think this judgment represents. Do you think that would be something fair, that would be a fair assessment?
Me?
Yes, Zain.
Okay. I think that's unfair, and it's not fair. It's unfair for the following reason. Reasons. First of all, transformation is a process.
Right?
Transformation is a process. You asked the question of comparing the independence judiciary and the current judiciary. The independence judiciary was a compromised colonial judiciary. And the constitution required that judiciary to be transformed. So again, in the architecture of the 2010 constitution, we knew we had to do something about a compromised judiciary. That's why there was a choice offered to judicial officers, either resign, go home, or go through a vetting process. So that the vetting process was one of the measures that was designed to give credibility to the holders of judicial offices so that, one, it took out those who were not suited, two, affirmed those who needed to, but also there was recruitment of new judges. Why am I saying it's a process? Also give credit to the first Chief Justice of this country, Dr. Willie Mutunga. He started a transformative process in the judiciary, and it takes time. It takes time. But I would like to compare this with other organs of the state and other constitutional offices and also independent offices. Compare the Judicial Service Commission and the other commissions. The other commissions, you have now a situation where majority of them, they've been compromised.
Yeah, they've been captured by the state.
By the state. And the people who are compliant have been the ones who have been put there. Yet we know that when we were looking at the architecture of governance, the three arms of government was not adequate. So we decided to design a fourth dimension, if you like. And that was constitutional commissions and independent offices. Remember how Ouko, the first auditor general, was hounded out of office. And all he was doing was doing his work. And then last 2 points. One, it is for that reason, that's why Article 3 of our constitution is there, that the responsibility to defend the constitution is a responsibility of everyone. And you see, in the language of the 2010 constitution, we actually draw a distinction sometimes between citizens and non-citizens. But this is one of the places where we say all persons. It doesn't matter if you are foreign or but you are in Kenya. It also doesn't matter if you are a registered company or you are a natural human being. All of us have a duty, responsibility to defend this constitution. Right. And then lastly, in terms of saying what has happened in terms of contextualizing what is going on in our country, the judiciary has become like the last line of defense. And sometimes I worry that because we as citizens are not carrying the burden of implementing this constitution and defending this constitution, we are putting undue pressure on the final arbiter, who is the judiciary. That's why when my brother Waikwa talks about boldness, we know that people use structures, sometimes some of them legal, some of them not legal, in the state to put pressure on state officers.
Right.
And then let me finish by saying, this thing went through parliament. Parliament is an arm of government. and you have absolutely eminent legal scholars in that parliament, people who are very highly qualified. And they were talking on both sides of their mouth. One saying, no, it is unconstitutional, but yes, I support it. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Marilyn, if I may bring you in on this. You have given a petition, the Chief Justice, to get Parliament dissolved because of its unconstitutionality. And it was for a long time that the immediate former CJ pretty much sat on that that petition, only issued it when he was on his way out the door. And those some of the reasons that we might think that it is not just an issue of structure in the sense that they don't have the capacity to do these things, but that there is, in essence, almost a reluctance, if you will, to take these sorts of bold decisions that the BBI judgment exhibited.
So I think I'm going to quibble with one little part of Zane's presentation, which is that, you know, the judiciary is carrying the load. I think the judiciary is carrying the load, but also citizens. I think we're having this discussion with Waikwa, and I was saying, actually, the people that the executive should really be afraid of are citizens, because who's bringing petitions to the court? It's citizens.
Right.
Right? You know, it's Kenyans saying, wait a second, no, that's not okay. I think that there is an imagination problem. I'm going to use Kiguru Macharia, Dr. Kiguru Macharia's framing here, that there are some of us who saw the Constitution and saw our aspirations and saw possibility. Right. And there are other people who saw a very limited landscape and saw an opportunity to claw back. And so when we constantly talk about the clawing back language, it's because their imagination is limited to what they have seen and what they've experienced. And so they're always trying to revert back to that. Right, and so I see this as a tug of war between us as citizens, those of us who are imagining something better and see the Constitution as a pathway to that, that better life, social, economic, political. It's not just aspirational. We're looking for tangible things as well. And then the people who are holding on. And I think that, you know, you see that friction both at an individual level and at an institutional level. And so when the former CJ Maraga was having difficulty with our petition, it's because he was like, who are these random chicks, for lack of a better word, who have the audacity to come here and use a provision of the Constitution to try and dissolve Parliament? And it required, you know, sort of bigger actors, LSK and others, to come and reiterate what we had said in 2017 for the Chief Justice to take it seriously. But I also know that I spoke with lots of scholars, you know, and legal practitioners, and they just laugh at me and poo-poo me and say, no, never, it could never be dissolved. Again, there's a lack of imagination. There's and there's an inability to see that for some of us, this is an opportunity. We see this constitution and we say, I think I could live a better life if these things were there. I always tell people, I don't fight these fights for fun. I actually want to be a beneficiary of the changed environment. And I have been. I'm very fortunate in that regard. So I think that there is an imagination problem. And I think it goes to what Atsango was talking about, which is, who do you put in place? It is not enough for us to have great laws. It's not enough for us to have, you know, beautiful judgments. Because with the wrong people in place, these judgments are meaningless. But finally, I want to talk about something. The judiciary is going to continue to have an expanded, amplified role as long as the legislature is failing. And so it's important for us to also shift our attention, right? Because it's legislative failures that are bringing us here. Because the judiciary doesn't really initiate cases, right? What's happening is citizens are saying, wait a second, you guys were supposed to check that during that process, and you're not. And so we're seeing large-scale failures at the representation level, at the executive level, and we're bringing all this to the judiciary. And it is unsustainable. So I think we really do need to have an honest, hard conversation with ourselves as citizens about how else do we shift attention to the legislature, to the executive? What are some of the things that we need to do to make sure that we're not really, really just drowning one arm of government? Because it's also, it becomes a strategy then for the non-functioning arms to essentially sink the functioning arm, right? So you force them to make difficult decisions that then cannot be, that cannot be implemented or will not be implemented. And so we're in this state of unconstitutionality. I mean, we're already there, but
If just to piggyback on what Marilyn has just said, if you look at the situation in the US, I mean, you've got this big sort of constant fights over who are going to be the judges in the Supreme Court. And in essence, it seems to me like, they are relegated, or they're putting on the judges there to be the arbiters of really political questions, you know. And I'm wondering whether with this sort of expanded role that the judiciary is taking here, are we replicating that? Are we going to get into a situation where who becomes the a judge of the Supreme Court then becomes a big issue, even in this case, a judge of the High Court becomes a big contestation between the two groups that have been mentioned of the people who see opportunity within the Constitution and people who see it as basically a threat. Are we in danger of getting there?
I'm not sure that we are in the danger of getting there, but let me just preface this by saying that unlike even the US, we have a very powerful judiciary based on what the Constitution provides. And one thing I think that was not appreciated just when 2010 Constitution was coming into effect is how powerful the judiciary or the Constitution made the judiciary to be. So a lot of people are not paying attention to the judiciary, partly because everybody, especially the power bearers, whether formal or informal power bearers, still believed that it was possible to continue with the past. And so it didn't really matter too much who becomes judge. And we saw that even in terms of Kibaki's first act, he thought he could just ignore the Constitution and appoint his buddies to be the Attorney General, Chief Justice, and I think Director of Public Prosecution. And based on what Marilyn was talking about, citizens were in court very quickly and thwarted his plan. So that's one. When you look at the US, for example, the Congress has significant power. Judiciary is restrained a lot on deciding some of the policy and what they consider to be political issues. So for example, in the US, they have what they call political question doctrine, whether an issue itself is political in nature, and so the judiciary should not touch it. And we know, for example, the current Supreme Court does subscribe quite a lot to that, just because of who is in that court and how they were appointed. Of course, this is where Paul Mwangi, the lead lawyer of BBI, wants to take us. A lot of us have seen him talk about judicialization of politics, saying that what the judiciary is doing is to take over politics and now be the one dictating how our politics should be done. But that's not obviously the case. The judiciary is given the power and the obligation to actually check compliance on exercise of public power, regardless of the subject matter. So in that way then, as long as first, and this for me is important and tying to what colleagues have said before, one, judges themselves need to appreciate their role in the Constitution. They need to appreciate, and now I have to credit both Asango and Zane here. There's a provision the constitutional makers, and we have two of them, and I know Bobby also is with us, Bobby Mkangi. 159, I think, 3 or 4E, where they say the judiciary is the one to protect the purpose and the principles of the Constitution. They didn't give purpose to anybody else, only right. The judiciary. When you think about what the purpose of the Constitution is social transformation. Mm-hmm. Judges have an active obligation to reimagine the society and to render their judgment so that their judgments can actually be used as tools to transform the society. And in a way, when you think about BBI judgment, that is what the judges, to some extent, were trying to do. The judges saw this is a coup. The Constitution places the people at the top, and all of a sudden, the political class has found a way to completely overturn that and now bring the politicians to be the one controlling the agenda. And the judges said, you can't do that because there is a history. So right. When judges fully appreciate that, they don't get mesmerized by jurisdiction like the US, which in a lot of ways are not comparable jurisdictions for us. They also fully appreciate the society they live in and the problems and how they need to interact with. And when we talk about the use of language in BBI, that's also a very intellectual, but also humbling way of judges understanding their people and how they need to communicate with them. Mm-hmm. Then I think we would be in a good place. Of course, there's always going to be contestation. And now right. There is a full appreciation, I think, within the political class, how important who becomes a judge is. And so we will be seeing more of that contestation.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that's where we are going to be headed. But just coming to the meat of what was in the judgment, Zane, maybe you can start us off on this. There's been a lot of talk of the idea of basic structure. And for me, first is to understand what is that basic structure? You know, it seems to me there wasn't a prescription that said that it is clauses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, and that's it, you know. So what exactly is that basic structure that is being protected, you know? And also a corollary to that is what happens when it's there, but it is not being implemented? Where are we left as citizens? You need to unmute your mic.
Thank you. Let me start where Marilyn stopped. and say that one of the things that should be appreciated is that of the three arms of three branches of government, we chose not to devolve the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we did not devolve the judiciary, not because we did not see models. The American Constitution, where we borrowed a lot of ideas from, has a devolved judiciary.
Right.
We went the route where my brother Waiko is saying, that the judiciary became above the fray of politics. We wanted mm-hmm. the judiciary to be above this other arms of government, and also to serve the country equally, and to be above the fray of the politics in the country. One of the reasons. But also importantly, when you have an executive that is devolved, so you have an executive at the national government and an executive at county, I haven't seen governors, executives protecting the judiciary. It's only when their rights are infringed, they go to the judiciary.
Right.
So I wanted to make that comment, but I'll come back to it because there's two other points that I wanted to make. But in terms of the basic structure, you go back to a number of things. One is the philosophy of this constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Two are the values of this constitution. Three is the design of this constitution. So that when you look at them holistically, the philosophy, the values, and the design is what gives you an idea of what the basic structure is. Secondly, because people have talked at least at a very technical level, I'm going to give Kenyans an example that can resonate with anyone. Say, for example, you are building a house, right? And you hire the right people to build the house for you. So you work with them, you agree what kind of aesthetics that house should have, what kind of conveniences that house should have, what kind of structure that house should have, mm-hmm. and you end up with a bungalow, right?
Right.
And you want a bungalow with a garden and other amenities. And you will then develop a foundation fitted for a bungalow.
Mm-hmm.
And then if somebody comes and say, now let us put a block of flats on top of this bungalow, right? Then the professional will tell you that the architecture of this house, the bungalow,
right.
cannot take a block of flats on top of it.
Right.
You may add a pool, a swimming pool. That mm. aesthetically, you may want to do that. You mm. may even add a room for a growing sun at the back without right. changing the aesthetics of the bungalow.
Right.
But if somebody came and said, "Now we own this bungalow together. Now we want to put a 10-story building on top of it," said, "No, hold on. This house cannot take another 10 structures on top."
Right.
Right. So that's the equivalent. And I think that's the similitude of what the basic structure philosophy is about. And we need to talk in this language so that people understand what this really means. So, for example, one of the fundamental principles in our constitution, which is part of that basic structure, is that it is the people who are sovereign.
Right.
You know, there was a question in this country. Sometimes the executive will claim that they are sovereign. And there was even a misnomer in our culture where people say the president is above the constitution. The president right. is above the law. How can he be above the law or she when that law is the one which is creating this person? So mm-hmm. we settled that once and for all and said, the people are sovereign.
Right.
Another one is the supremacy of the constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So if you talk about in this constitution, we said nothing can be done outside this constitution. It has to be done under this constitution, in accordance with this constitution. So when you have people who want to do this outside, they are always brought back. And I'll give you three examples. You know, people think the executive or the legislature were the first one to test this concept of the supremacy of the constitution. No, it was not. It was the judiciary. The first people who wanted to test this constitution was the serving judicial officers who said, we don't want to be vetted.
Right.
We don't want to be vetted. And you remember the way they even went to court to their brother and sister judges and said, we don't want to be vetted. We resolved that very easily and said, no, you'll have to be vetted.
Right.
The first deputy chief justice of this country was refused to retire. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, I was appointed in the former constitution. So again, it was tested. And then I'll give you an example of the of parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Both the National Assembly and the Senate, they passed a law claiming that they are not state officers. Because when they wanted to allocate themselves perks, they were told, no, now as state officers, you fall under the purview of the Salaries and Remuneration Commission.
Right.
So you cannot change that. And then they passed a law and claimed that they are not state officer because of that law.
Yeah.
Again, it was tested. So I'm giving you examples of saying we can talk about the broad nature of what this architecture is. But let me make two last points on the basic structure. One, we are not saying you cannot alter the basic structure. That's not what this judgment is saying. And it is wrong for people to claim that it is saying that. It is saying if you want to change the basic structure, you must follow the same process or even a higher standard to address the issue of changing the structure. Right? And I'll give you an example that in both the law that supervise the constitution-making process of CKRC and the Committee of Experts, the intentions and the matters that were going to be addressed were put in the law, right? So that they became justiciable, meaning you could go to court and enforce them if they were not addressed.
Right.
So in a nutshell, and this is the last point I wanted to make, in a nutshell, you, in terms of what Marilyn was saying about imagination, the part of the challenge of imagination is that we, some people cannot construe a different system from the oppressive system that was rejected totally by this constitution.
Right.
And when we say part of this imagination is that we are saying fundamentally this constitution, the approach that it took, both in terms of its law that established the review process and the process itself and the outcome, was that it was rejecting a past that was unjust, and it was envisaging a future that is just. Now, this envisaging is part of the challenge many people are having. So this basic structure is also related to that rejection of an oppressive past.